Meant to do last week before we get started on chapter 4 tonight is mention some commentaries that I have bought over the years, and I've used these along with the pulpit commentaries. But one of them is called A Commentary on Job. It's by Homer Haley, and that's a very, very good book. And I've gotten some of my references from there. Another one is a really good one. It's called A Study of Job from Tragedy to Triumph, and it's by H.L. Ellison. And that's another really, really good one. It's a smaller book, but he has some really concise points in there. And then one of the best ones I have is one called Job, An Introduction and Commentary by Francis Anderson. And this is a really good one too. So those three, if you're ever looking for some detailed information, as we mentioned last week, Job is a very, very old book, perhaps 3,000 or 4,000 years old. And it has some insights that we'll talk about later on that are scientific facts that they've discovered, quote unquote, in modern science in the last 100 years, that Job points out 3,000 or 4,000 years ago. And that's how Schnabel wrote his book called God. What is it? Help me out here. Has God Spoken? And you turn it over, it says God has spoken. And it will actually point some of those out. So we're going to begin tonight in chapter 4. And I'm going to have Kevin, if you would, start reading for us in a minute. So this is where we're at on the outline, though. We're starting the first cycle. So we've had then the stage has been set. Satan has accused God of basically pampering Job. Job is a good man because he's been bought. And so we went through all of the things that Job went through with the removal of all his wealth and possessions, and then the removal of all of his health, and he lost all of his children and everything he owned. And so that's kind of where the stage is set now. The debate now begins. And we're going to pick that debate up with the first of the three friends called Eliphaz, and he's the Temanite. And so that's where we're going to start tonight. So I'm going to have Kevin, if you would, read entirety chapter 4, and then we'll start taking some points out of there.
Then Eliphaz the Temanite answered and said, "If one ventures a word with you, will you be impatient? Yet who can keep from speaking? Behold, you have instructed many, and you have strengthened the weak hands. Your words have upheld him who is stumbling, and you have made firm the feeble knees. But now it has come to you, and you are impatient. It touches you, and you are dismayed. Is not your fear of God your confidence, and the integrity of your ways your hope? Remember, who that was innocent ever perished? Or where were the upright cut off? As I have seen, those who plow iniquity and sow trouble reap the same. By the breath of God they perish, and by the blast of his anger they are consumed. The roar of the lion, the voice of the fierce lion, the teeth of the young lions are broken. The strong lion perishes for lack of prey, and the cubs of the lioness are scattered. Now a word was brought to me stealthily, my ear received the whisper of it. Amid thoughts from visions of the night, when deep sleep falls on men, dread came upon me, and trembling, which made all my bones shake. A spirit glided past my face, the hair of my flesh stood up. It stood still, but I could not discern its appearance. A form was before my eyes, there was silence, then I heard a voice. Can mortal man be in the right before God? Can a man be pure before his Maker? Even in his servants he puts no trust, and his angels he charges with error. How much more those who dwell in houses of clay, whose foundations is in the dust, who are crushed like the moth? Between morning and evening they are beaten to pieces. They perish forever without anyone regarding it. Is not their tent cord plucked up within them? Do they not die, and that without wisdom?"
Okay, thank you, Kevin. That's part A. Eliphaz continues in chapter 5 with part B, but we're going to stop here and take some note of some things that he is saying. And first of all, here in chapter 4, at the very beginning, I want to point out Eliphaz, as we'll read, is somewhat of a gentleman. He's a lot more sympathetic and he's a lot more courteous to Job. When we get to Zophar and Bildad, they just blatantly come out and say, "Job, you're all messed up, you've sinned greatly." Eliphaz, at least, is a little more sympathetic. And so he approaches things kind of gently. When you get down to verse number 7 in chapter 4, this is the common view of the time. This is what I was referring to last week as the orthodox view. And that is the view that these wise men and even Job himself had was that if a man was blessed with good things in this life and had good health and many children and many possessions, he was righteous with God. By the same token, on the other hand, if a man had nothing, if he had no possessions, if he had all kinds of diseases, he must be a sinful person, and therefore God is rewarding him appropriately. This is what we call the orthodox view. And up until now, this was Job's view as well. And we're going to see he starts wrangling with this and wrangling with this throughout the rest of the book of Job, because he realizes, I'm not a sinful person. I love God, and I worship God, and I sacrifice for my children. And so he starts wrangling with, why is this happening? Either something's really, really wrong, or his orthodox view is wrong. And so we're going to come to that realization. And Eliphaz, when you get to verses 12 through 21, Eliphaz explains his religious view. And his whole religious life revolves around a revelation, quote unquote, that God had given him in this dream. And this is when he talks about the fact that the spirit passed before his face and the hairs on his body stood up. And he heard a voice going by saying, can a mortal be more righteous than God and more pure than his maker? And so then he comes, kind of draws it to a point and says, you know, if God charges his angels with error and he puts no trust in his servants, how much less than mankind, man who lives on this earth, who is made out of dust. And so he expresses this dream or revelation and the profound realization of the sinfulness of man. And so his point here, when we get down to verse 18, is that if God charges, you know, the erring angels with sinful conditions, won't he also deal with sinful man? And there's a reference I had here that we'll look up. If you want to flip over briefly to Job chapter 15, there's a similar point made here that Eliphaz makes when he's accusing Job. And he makes basically the same statement. He says in chapter 15 of Job, verses 15 and 16, if God puts no trust in his saints and the heavens are not pure in his sight, how much less man who is abominable and filthy, who drinks iniquity like water. So Eliphaz later states this again in chapter 15, the same concept that God has erring angels, and if he has to deal with erring angels, how much more will he deal with mankind who is so very sinful on this earth? He goes on, though, in some more points we want to kind of take note of. At this point in chapter 4, he really hasn't passed judgment on Job, but the insinuation is there. If God charges his erring and sinful angels, what about sinful men? And basically, in the vernacular, we would say in our modern-day language, Job, if the shoe fits, if the sandal fits, wear it. You know, this is how God operates, and this is what's happening to you, so connect the dots. So basically, he's trying to, like I said, he's a lot more polite than some of the other two friends. But he says, Job, if the shoe fits, let's wear it. And so he finally comes more to a conclusion that for Job, what's happening to you, Job, you're being chastened by God. And that's where he goes in chapter 5. And I'm going to have BJ read chapter 5 for us. This is part B of Eliphaz's speech. And so we're going to go into chapter 5. This is where he kind of comes to the conclusion that, Job, you're being chastened by God. Bruce, do you have
a... I just wanted to say, though, in verse 17, can mankind be just before God? That's a legitimate question. Mm-hmm. And we know that you can't. It's only through prayer and repentance. So they put enough truth into their accusation that it's hard to refute.
And then the other part, too, which we have the advantage of, we're on the other side of the cross, and we can be justified before God because our sins have been forgiven. But this is on the other side of the cross, and these are all very, very good questions. And I don't want to have you assume I'm underestimating. These were the wisest men of their age. These were men of the East, and all of these three friends were very wealthy and very wise. They came a long, long way to comfort Job. But because of their spiritual and religious views, the only thing they could come to the conclusion of was that Job was a sinful man. Yeah. And so that is what they're all wrangling with, including Job himself.
Yeah. And we know that Job is acceptable to God. So that much we know ahead of time.
Exactly.
So these questions don't, but they're, like I say, there's just enough truth.
Absolutely.
To sway the thought of, see, I'm valid.
That's right. That's right. And we're going to see that this is the hardest thing for all of them, including Job, is to maybe our views were wrong. Maybe bad things do happen to good people. And so we're kind of going to get there as we go. So, but very good point. I appreciate you bringing it up. Okay, BG, would you read chapter 5 in its entirety? Then we'll start through there.
Call now. Is there anyone who will answer you? To which of the holy ones will you turn? Surely vexation kills the fool and jealousy slays the simple. I have seen the fool taking root, but suddenly I curse his dwelling. His children are far from safety. They are crushed in the gate, and there is no one to deliver them. The hungry eat his harvest, and he takes it even out of thorns, and the thirsty pant after his wealth. For affliction does not come from the dust, nor does trouble sprout from the ground. But man is born to trouble as the sparks fly up. As for me, I would seek God, and to God would I commit my cause. Who does great things and unsearchable, marvelous things without number? He gives the rain on the earth and sends water on the fields. He sets on high those who are lowly, and those who mourn are lifted to safety. He frustrates the devices of the crafty so that their hands achieve no success. He catches the wise in their own craftiness, and the schemes of the wily are brought to a quick end. They meet with darkness in the daytime, and they grope at noonday as in the night. But he saves the needy from the sword of their mouth and from the hand of the mighty. So the poor have hope, and the injustices shut her mouth. Behold, blessed is the one whom God reproves, and therefore despise not the discipline of the Almighty. For he wounds, but he binds up. He shatters, but his hands heal. He will deliver you from six troubles, and seven no evil shall touch you. In famine he will redeem you from death, and in war from the power of the sword. You shall be hidden from the lash of the tongue, and shall not fear destruction when it comes. At destruction and famine you shall laugh, and shall not fear the beasts of the earth. For you shall be in league with the stones of the field, and the beasts of the field shall be at peace with you. You shall know that your tent is at peace, and you shall inspect your fold and miss nothing. You shall know also that your offspring shall be many, and your descendants as grass of the earth. You shall come to your grave in ripe old age, like a sheaf gathered up in its season. Behold, this we have searched out. It is true. Hear and know it for your good.
Okay, so if we kind of sit back, thank you, BG. If we kind of sit back and just look at the whole message, take the 10,000 foot view from Eliphaz, it basically comes down to, Job, these things have happened to you, and my conclusion is that you're being chastened by God for something. You are receiving the chastening of the Lord. And so it's a very simplistic view, but that is his assertion. Remember, he's the first one out of the gate. This is the very first cycle of the first debate. And so one of the things he states is kind of an altruistic view in verse 7. It's a verse that we do use from time to time. He says, that man is born to trouble, just like the sparks fly upward. It's a very famous passage that's used a lot. And his message is, man is always into trouble with sinfulness, just like sparks fly upward. And then his really where the jab starts is in verse 8. He says, but as for me, I would seek God. As if Job wasn't already seeking God. But he's now pointing that, you need to start seeking God, Job. And after all, God does great, great things and unsearchable things. So his point is man is sinful. Man is born to trouble. Job, you need to start seeking God. Now, it's an interesting thing that in verse 9, it says God does unsearchable things without number. And that's very similar to Ecclesiastes. If you just flip over to Ecclesiastes chapter 3 and verse 11, very similar type thought. The writer Solomon says that God, he has made everything beautiful in its time, and he has put eternity in their hearts, except that no one can find out the work that God does from beginning to end. So God does all kinds of things, unsearchable things, that we don't know. And so he's kind of coming to the point, in his conclusion here that, Job, God disciplines us, and it happens to all of us, and this is what's happening to you. You are being disciplined, so whatever you do, Job, don't despise this correction. And that's kind of what he's saying down in verse 17. He says, "Behold, happy is the man whom God corrects. Therefore, do not despise the chastening of the Almighty." And then he gives some examples. He says, "For he bruises and he binds up, and he wounds and he makes whole again." And so he's basically encouraging Job, you know, this is happening for a reason. You're being chastened. And therefore, Job, you're being chastened for a reason. Seek God out and let's get through this. And because this happens to all of us, God will bruise and will bind up. He'll wound and he'll make whole again. Bottom line is, Job, you're being chastened by God. And that's really the message here in his at the start. So any thoughts or questions before we move on to Job's rebuttal? Because Job has some interesting things that he brings up, and so we're going to get into chapter 6 and 7 are much more lengthy in process, and these are both two chapters where Job then is responding. He'll hit several points throughout the chapters 6 and 7 that refer directly back to what Eliphaz just said in chapters 4 and 5. So we're going to get in now to his response in verse number and starting in chapter number 6. So if there's nothing else, we'll go ahead and continue on. And so the theme of chapter 6 is my complaint is just. Job never comes to the conclusion or admits to some sinful condition just to get these guys off his back. He maintains his position that he has been serving God, and therefore he's not going to admit to some kind of sinful condition or sinful practice just because his friends think that he's sinful. So I'll read chapter 6 for us, and then we'll get in and we'll take notes of several things. So this is when Job then answers his first rebuttal. "And Job answered and said, 'Oh, that my grief were fully weighed, and my calamity laid with it in the balances. For then it would be heavier than the sands of the sea. Therefore my words have been rash, for the arrows of the Almighty are within me. My spirit drinks in their poison. The terrors of God are arrayed against me. Does the wild donkey bray when he has grass? Does the ox low over its fodder? Can flavorless food be eaten without salt? Or is there any taste in the white of an egg? My soul refuses to touch them. They are as loathsome food to me. Oh, that I might have my request, that God would grant me the thing that I long for, that it would please God to crush me, that he would loose his hand and cut me off. Then I would have comfort. Then in anguish I would exult. Let him not spare, for I have not concealed the words of the Holy One. What strength do I have that I should hope? And what is my end that I should prolong my life? Is my strength the strength of stones? Or is my flesh bronze? Is my help not within me? And is success driven from me? To him who is afflicted, kindness should be shown by his friend. Even though he forsakes the fear of the Almighty, my brothers have dealt deceitfully like a brook, like the streams of the brooks that pass away, which are dark because of the ice, and into which the snow vanishes. When it is warm, they cease to flow, and when it is hot, they vanish from their place. The paths of their way turn aside, they go nowhere, and they perish. Their caravans of Tema look, and the travelers of Sheba hope for them. They are disappointed because they were confident, and they come there and are confused. For now you are nothing. You see terror and are afraid. Did I ever say, bring something to me, or offer a bribe for me from your wealth, or deliver me from the enemy's hand, or redeem me from the hand of my oppressors? Teach me and I will hold my tongue. Cause me to understand wherein I have erred. How forceful are right words, But what does your arguing prove? Do you intend to reprove my words and the speeches of a desperate one, which are as the wind? Yes, you overwhelm the fatherless, and you undermine your friend. Now therefore be pleased to look at me, for I would never lie to your face. Turn now, let there be no injustice. Yes, turn again. My righteousness still stands. Is there any injustice on my tongue? Cannot my taste discern the unsavory? So Job comes back with a fairly weighted counter-argument, and we're going to take note of quite a few things. In verses 2 and 3 here of chapter 6, I want you to notice Job is describing the weight of what he has gone through as if being heavier than the sands of the sea. And we all know how heavy sand is and how much sand is on the oceans of the world. And he says this calamity, is, if it was put in balances, it would be heavier than all the sands of the sea. And therefore, this is kind of why he has such rash words, because you got to remember, Job has suffered basically the loss of everything. Even to the point where his wife told him to curse God and die. He's lost his children, all his possessions, and we'll get into later into how desperate his skin condition was in chapter 7. But the weight of the burden was huge. And so Job then says a series of rhetorical no's in verses 5 through 6, and that's when he gives the expressions, does a wild donkey bray when he has grass? The answer is no. When he has grass, he's got food to eat, he's happy, he's not braying. Does the ox low over its fodder? No, when he has fodder to eat, he's not lowing over that. Can flavorless food be eaten without salt? These are all rhetorical no's. The answer again is no. Is there any taste in the white of an egg? I've seen this. I've actually seen this poster in restaurants. You know, it was along the lines of something similar to eating an egg without salt is like kissing a man without a mustache or something like that. But you'll see it in restaurants. But these are rhetorical no's, and so Job is bringing this to a point. And from these rhetorical no's, and what his point is in verse 7 is that Eliphaz's words, like what he described here with these rhetorical no's, his words are unseasoned, and they're not palatable. He can't swallow the words that Eliphaz just gave him. So these are unpalatable, unsavory, unseasoned words, and Job just cannot palate them. And then he shifts after that direct counter to Eliphaz to his desire. Really, he wants God just to kill him. He says, God, just crush me. Just cut me off. Now, this isn't going to be the first time that Job makes statements like this. And you got to remember, Satan has given Job the most painful disease he could think of to prove God wrong. And so you have to imagine, whatever this was, and we don't really know the exact condition, it was probably the most painful thing that anybody could endure. And so he is really, really suffering. And he's to the point now where he says, God, please just kill me. Just cut me off. And then he reaffirms his position that I haven't concealed the words of the Holy One. In other words, he's still vindicating himself and saying, I have not done unjustly. I haven't concealed God's words. In verses 14 and 15 here, he basically comes to the conclusion that he tells Eliphaz, all of you guys that have come here to comfort me, you're false friends, because you should be showing me kindness. And that's really the message he's saying here. All he wanted, all he asked of his friends, and if you look down at verses 22 and 23, is some understanding and some sympathy. He doesn't want their money. He doesn't want any kind of valiant deeds. He just wants them to sit with him and understand and sympathize and understand what he's going through. BJ.
Well, and Job's retort here in verse 14 is a direct counter to two things that he said, Eliphaz, when he said, is not the fear of God your confidence, and is not your integrity the ways of your hope? And then later on he says, well, as for me, I would seek God. And it's really interesting because Job sees through his hypocrisy, though this man claims to be speaking words that are true and conjured from his fear of God, Job recognizes that he truly does not have a fear of God because of the way that he treats man. And I think there's a complete lesson in there that mm-hmm. if you want to see someone who truly fears the Lord, look at how they treat their fellow man, and that will be an indication of their fear of the Lord.
And appreciate that point, and recognize Eliphaz is probably the more gentlemanly of the three. So we're going to get into some real mudslinging later on as we get into later chapters. But Job's point is, I didn't ask you to come here and bring me money. I didn't ask you to do any kind of special deeds for me. I didn't ask you to deliver me from my condition. I just wanted some understanding and some sympathy. And that's something I think there's a modern day application for us as Christians. When someone is going through a really, really rough time in their life, people tell, well, just get it straightened out. No, sometimes people just need you to sit down and talk with them and listen to them. If someone's battling cancer, sometimes they don't, you may not have the answer for them, but sometimes all they want is to sit there and hold their hand and sympathize with them and understand what they're going through. And that's what Job is saying. He says, you're supposed to be my friends. I want you to come here and sit down with me and understand what I'm doing and going through, but instead, you're making accusations. And he kind of comes to a point here in verse 24. He basically draws the line and says, all right, you teach me and I'll hold my tongue. Where have I erred? So he's basically calling your bluff. He says, tell me where I've sinned. You tell me what I have done to have this kind of condition happen to me. Name my sin. And I'll hold my mouth, teach me. You tell me where I have sinned. And that's going to be a problem for his three friends as we go on through all the other chapters, because they cannot name the sin. They make all kinds of accusations, but they don't do right with Job in doing that. And so all Job says is, you should have been my friends, and instead you come here and you condemn me. And then at the point at the end here I have at the bottom of this chart is that true sympathy and understanding are sometimes more costly than charity. And that's all Job wanted. He didn't want their money. He didn't want their wealth. He just wanted some sympathy and some understanding. And I thought really a really good point. And do you have a question, Bruce?
No.
Okay. In verse 28, Job, and I can see Job doing this, he looks at them in verse 28, and he says, you be pleased to look at me. Now, you got to remember, Job's face was probably hideous. He was so deformed with this skin disease, they didn't even recognize their friend of many, many years when they came there. he turns his face to them, and he says, I would never lie to your face. So he's calling their bluff. He's looking and says, name my sin. And he looks at them and says, you be pleased to know I will never lie to you. And so I can see Job turning his face and turning to his accusers and say, I won't lie to you. I'll tell you the truth. And then the final point, and then I'll take any questions or thoughts you have, is he again makes reference to those unsavory words of Eliphaz earlier, like the egg without salt. And that's down in verse 30 when he says, is there injustice on my tongue? Cannot my taste discern the unsavory? Again, these words that Eliphaz had said were unsavory. They were words that he could not, they weren't palatable to him. They weren't seasoned with grace. They weren't seasoned with wisdom. They were unsavory. So he again makes this reference to the egg, the white of an egg that's unseasoned. Okay, any thoughts or questions? Bruce.
Well, in verse 29, it says, desist now. And this is his introduction to there's something else besides sin. Uh-huh. He says, change your course, seek some other explanation for my troubles.
Right.
So that's his first introduction is, hey, maybe this isn't because of my sin.
Right.
And so this is his first introduction into maybe there's something else besides what's going on here, which is a challenge to their belief system.
And again, it's a challenge to his belief system too. And that is the most interesting thing I think of, is that Job had the same orthodox view as they did at the start of all this. They all had pretty much the same view. If you had blessings in life and many children and good health and God, you were righteous in the sight of God. If you didn't have those things, you were condemned because of some kind of sin. And that forces Job to rethink his view. And if you can think of just, you know, in your own life, if you were presented with a religious truth that changed your entire view of what you believed, that's a very tough pill to swallow sometimes. And for, I know many of us that, myself, I'll just use myself as an example. I came out of a denominational world, and coming to the truth from the denominations was a very tough pill to swallow. And sometimes you have to rethink everything you thought was right. So, BJ. And then JC.
Verse 28, when Job says, I'm not going to lie to your face, I think it's interesting that Eliphaz earlier says, you know, is there any man that can stand upright before God? And it seems to be a rhetorical question where his answer is no. But if that's the case, then Eliphaz, just like Job, has sinned, and yet Eliphaz remains his in with his possessions and such. And so, in a way, his argument to Job is very hypocritical, and he's lied to Job's face because he's basically, because of his position, claiming, I'm right before God, mm-hmm. and yet you are not, and yet that's a lie, it would appear. And so I'm not sure if that's a correct assumption.
I think it's one of many that, and we all know the end of the story. In the end, Job has to make sacrifices for them, for their sin, because of their bad representation of God's righteousness. So that's quite possible. JC, I think you had your hand up.
One thing that I feel sometimes gets lost in some of this is that we know the end of the story and what God ends up having to speak to Job about. And so less about Job questioning his beliefs and more about, I mean, we see the spirit in Revelation that we kind of pass off, but who knows if that spirit was not Satan himself talking to Eliphaz and reinforcing what they thought they understood. Mm-hmm. And so it just goes to show more that we can't always listen to our friends and we can't listen to those who we think are spiritually minded, that they could be just, they can be deluded by Satan just as well as anyone. And in the end, it's God we have to listen to.
That's right. And the we have to put ourselves in the shoes of these three friends, because these men had known Job their whole life. And they had come a long, long way. And if you remember from the earlier chapters, they didn't say a word for 7 days. They sat there and saw how great his suffering was, and they didn't say a word. And that 7 days, as we discussed last week, is the same period of time that someone would mourn for the dead. And these men, I think, genuinely cared for Job, but when confronted with either their view of religion versus Job's condition, they chose their view of religion. And so to them, they couldn't budge on that. It had to be that Job had done something terrible. And so, but also, and as Job points out, they didn't have any sympathy or understanding, and that really bothers Job. John and Marv. JC.
I've noticed two New Testament references out of both talk and response. One out of Hebrews, one out of Acts 20, where the New Testament writers actually looks like they are quoting both men. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That you should not ignore the chasing of the Lord.
Right. And again, I think because the author of both those books is God, the Holy Spirit, we get references like that, you know, that to Job. Okay, Marv, you had a question or a thought?
My comment is, maybe I'm wrong, but I'm kind of seeing this chapter 6 here as a start. Job expounded his great faith in God
It does, and it gets even more so as we go. Job less and less. I mean, he responds briefly to his friend's comments, then he keeps turning to God and addressing God. And you're going to see that more and more. He gets less distracted by what his friends are saying, and he starts turning and addressing God in person, and to the point where he's asking for an appointment with God. And we're going to get a little bit of that here in in chapter 7. So let's go ahead and read. We've got about 10 minutes. We'll get through chapter 7. This is the final, this is part B of Job's response. And Job, it's entitled, I title it, my suffering is, let me get it over here. My suffering is comfortless. And so let's read chapter 7. This is Job still continuing his speech. Is not there a time of hard service for man on the earth? Are not his days also like the days of a hired man, like a servant who earnestly desires the shade, like a hired man who eagerly looks for his wages? So I have been allotted months of futility, and wearisome nights have been appointed to me. When I lie down, I say, when shall I arise and the night be ended? For I have had my fill of tossing until dawn. My flesh is caked with worms and dust. My skin is cracked and it breaks out afresh. My days are swifter than a weaver's shuttle and are spent without hope. Oh, remember that my life is a breath. My eye will never again see good. The eye of him who sees me will see me no more. While your eyes are upon me, I shall no longer be. As a cloud disappears and vanishes away, so is he who goes to the grave and does not come up. He shall never return to his house, nor shall his place know him any more. Therefore I will not restrain my mouth. I will speak in the anguish of my spirit, and I will complain in the bitterness of my soul. Am I a sea or a sea serpent that you set a guard over me? When I say my bed will comfort me and my couch will ease my complaint, then you scare me with dreams and terrify me with visions, so that my soul chooses strangling and death rather than my body. I loathe my life. I would not live forever. Let me alone, for my days are but a breath. What is man that you should magnify him, that you should set your heart on him, that you should visit him every morning and test him every moment? How long will you not look away from me and let me alone till I swallow my spit? Have I sinned? What have I done to you, O watcher of men? Why have you sent me as your target so that I am a burden to myself? When do you not pardon my transgression and take away my iniquity? For now I will lie down in the dust, and you will seek me diligently, but I will no longer be. Okay, this is one of those examples where Job makes some references to the men again, and then he turns and starts addressing God, and we're going to talk a little bit about that. First thing, in verse 4, we're going to see that Job is suffering from insomnia. He says he finds no relief in sleep. When it's night, he longs for the day. When it's day, he longs for the night. And it appears that he's even having dreams at night, horrible dreams. And so the night is even worse than the day. So again, I think part of the anguish that Satan has put upon Job, he's suffering horribly and from this condition. And I think also in verse 5 that we can understand that not only is this physical pain, but he's also in mental anguish. Remember all the things mentally he's gone through. He's lost all of his children. He's lost all of his possessions. He thinks he's lost his relationship to God. He's lost his health. And we are given a very, very detailed example from Job himself about this physical pain, the absolutely repulsive description of his skin. He says, my flesh wears maggots as clothes, and my skin is caked with dirt, and it's scabby and it's festering with pus. Whatever this was that Job had, he had maggots. Maggots will only eat dead skin. He had maggots all over his body, and so he would scrape these maggots off with a piece of pottery. And you got to remember, this wasn't just one location of his body. It said that he was, cursed by God, or struck by Satan from the crown of his head to the sole of his feet. And so this is a horribly repulsive description. And this description is from Job himself. Now remember, where is he sitting? Out in the dunghill, okay? We all know what dung is. And so he's sitting out here on a dunghill scraping worms off his body. And also appears that these boils are continuing to grow and fester. And so he's always having to scrape them. and along with the worms that are eating the dead flesh. So this is a horrible, horrible, horrible condition. We don't really know exactly what it was, but suffice to say, Satan gave him something that would have been really bad. Bruce.
Now, the thing that amazes me is that God and Satan both denied him the opportunity to die.
Yes.
He has to endure. He doesn't know it, but he has to endure.
He does.
And
part of this then is, and we're going to actually move there in verse 7, he then starts addressing God. You know, he's now deplored his condition. And so if you take a look down at verse 7, he actually, you know, and the commentators say this is where he really turns his head, looking up, and he starts addressing God. And in verse 7, he says, "Well, remember that my life is a breath." Okay, he's not talking to the men. He's talking to his Creator. And so one of the things he's saying here is that he addresses this to God, and Job wants God to leave him alone. He thinks that God has still got his finger on him, like, you know, you and I would put our finger on an ant. And he wants God to leave him alone, but he also wants God to take notice of him. He's basically asking, why? God, don't you see me? Don't you know what I'm going through? And so he's very much in pain. And verse 8 is one that will come up over and over and over again in several chapters. His reasoning to himself is that he's going to be dead soon. And so, God, you better take some action because you're going to come looking for me and I won't be around anymore. And that's really what he's trying to say is, you're going to come and looking for me and it's going to be too late, God, because I'm going to be dead. And so Job certainly felt like he was going to die from this situation and this type of condition. Okay, just a couple more things. Any other comments before we move on? Verse 12 is an interesting thing, and I had to do some research on this one. He talks a reference to God. He says, "Am I the sea or a sea serpent?" And actually what he's referring to here is some Canaanite terms. Basically the translation is, "Do you think that I am Yam," which is the sea, "or that I am Tannin?" And Tannin was known as the sea monster. And so he's asking God, you know, am I the sea or am I a sea monster? Are you dealing, being treated like this because I'm some kind of a monster? And this was a Canaanite reference. And so that's basically his logic here is, God, am I some kind of monster to you that you're doing this horrendous situation with me? And so he's questioning, why, God? Am I some kind of a monstrous being to you? In verse 17, he says, and this is quoted, I just put this up here for your reference, "What is man that you should magnify him and you should set your heart on him and you should visit him every morning?" That is almost a direct quote that David uses in Psalms 8 in verses 3 through 6. So again, this same language is used later on by David about what is man that you magnify him and you pay attention to him. In verse 19, Job has the feeling that he can't get a moment's privacy. In other words, it's just like we were describing, like God has his finger on him. He says, "I can't even swallow my own spit." Okay, he is in so much anguish, so much pain. He can't eat, he can't sleep. He has dreams if he tries to sleep. He's got insomnia. And he just feels like the hand of God is firmly upon him, even to the point he can't even take a moment to swallow his own spit. So, very dreadful type condition. Job in verses 20 and 21 actually comes up with a set of questions for God. And this is very interesting because God later on, as we know, because we have the advantage of reading the whole book, God has his set of questions for Job later on when he appears in the whirlwind. But Job has a series of questions beginning in verses 20 and 21. And the first question really is, God, what have I done to you? And then the second question really is, God, have I sinned? And the third question is, why can't I be forgiven? Whatever it is I've done, why don't you forgive me? Job knows that he, and as far as all men, are all other men are sinners, but he also knows God's remedy for sin is forgiveness. And remember, this is all during the patriarchal age. And so his thought is, why doesn't God forgive me? And so Job again states that he's going to be dead soon. So this is repeated again. God, you're going to come looking for me. It's going to be too late. I'm already going to be gone. So he definitely felt like he was not going to last very long. And God, if he does respond, it's going to be too late. And so I think the important thing, and we'll kind of wrap up here, is, you know, we all have the advantage of seeing the big picture from the 10,000 foot level. My last point is, little does Job know that God is watching with silent compassion and admiration for his servant Job. And this is going to continue until the test is fully done. God does know, God does care, and God's watching what happens. Because Job doesn't know about this whole situation that was set up between himself and Satan. And that's really it. Anybody have any final thoughts or questions? Heather.
Is his wife with him right now?
Well, she is still alive. We don't know anything past the point that she asked him, curse God and die, but we don't know anything past
she
that.
He might be sitting with him while he's talking with his friends, huh?
Could be.
Could be.
We know he has children later on when he's restored, so I'm assuming his wife is still alive.
I just find it interesting that she stayed alive. He lost everything, but he didn't lose her.
Didn't lose her.
And that kind of sounds kind of like a torture in itself after what she said.
It certainly didn't help the situation, yeah. Okay, then.
Do we know how long this suffering went on?
You know, I actually don't know. You know, all we have recorded is the time that the friends come and they have this dialogue and then God appears. I don't really know. I haven't really found anything that stated how long this occurred. BJ?
Well, if you look at what Job says at the beginning of 7.
Uh-huh.
Travel back then wasn't these friends hopped in a car and,
right,
and
right.
went over. It would have news of it traveling to them and them getting
them traveling there
would have been a period of months that have already gone by, it seems like. So
yeah, very could be months. I don't really know, but I think BG's got a very good point, though, is that, you know, these people didn't have caravans, cars or anything they hopped onto. They traveled pretty much on foot. And remember, when they finally got there, they even sat there for a whole week before the dialogue even begins. So anyway, that is the first cycle with the first friend. And so next week, we're going to pick up with verses 8, 9, and 10. And this is going to be the dialogue with the second friend by the name of Bildad. And he's even a little rougher. And then we get to Zophar, and he's just downright mean. But we're gonna get through all this. So thank you very much for your comments. I have handouts for both chapters 1 through 3 and then tonight's in the back if you need them. Thank you.